Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest is here to defend President Obama's $787 billion stimulus bill, which of course was his first major act in office and one that often gets derided as the failed stimulus. Actually, no, my guest is not just here to defend the stimulus. He's here to argue it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Time Magazine national correspondent Michael Grunwald has written a book called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the WNYC.
Hey, how you doing?
And just to give, I know you're laughing at my characterization of your book, but to give the listeners an idea to start out of how great you think the Recovery Act bill or stimulus was, you write that it created 2.5 million jobs, increased GDP around 3%, was the most transformational energy bill in history, financed one of the most aggressive education reforms in history, dragged our antiquated medical system into the digital age, provided the biggest middle-class tax cut since Reagan, the largest investment in infrastructure since Eisenhower, and it's been on time, under budget, and basically fraud-free. Wow.
Well, all those things are facts. You know, I remember I've been sort of a boring news reporter for 20 years. I didn't come in this as some kind of, you know, Obama shill. And some people may not like the direction it's taking energy or education or healthcare. But the fact is, to use energy as an example, that, you know, we were spending a few billion dollars a year on clean energy, and this poured in $90 billion. You know, unprecedented investments in renewables and efficiency and advanced biofuels and a smart grid and the factories to build all that green stuff in America. It was clearly just this gigantic story that was hiding in plain view, and so I wanted to tell it.
And beyond all the stats, I don't know if you heard our conversation with Thomas Friedman earlier, where he was saying where Obama has failed is not so much in his policies, in Friedman's opinion, but in his ability to articulate the narrative of hope and change around his policies, which, of course, he was elected on. But you say that the stimulus was the purest distillation of what Obama meant by change. Explain that.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, people didn't really pay attention to his campaign promises and his agenda in 2008, partly because they were more interested in his race and his pastor and the ads comparing him to Paris Hilton, but partly because his agenda was basically the standard Democratic agenda of the day, which was essentially reversing the Bush era and investing in the future, and in energy and healthcare and education and sort of restructuring more research, more infrastructure, a fairer tax code. The Recovery Act, sort of in his first month in office, before his staff even knew where the bathrooms were in the West Wing, he went ahead and made gigantic down payments on so many of these campaign promises. Now, what he didn't do was change Washington, which was the sort of flip side of the Obama aura, right? I mean, that it was going to be post-partisan, that it was going to change the, you know, we weren't going to be so silly and petty, and that until you really had fundamental change in Washington, you couldn't have fundamental change in the country. Well, this went through the same old Washington, and it really showed that he's more, you know, he may have campaigned as a change the system outsider, but he's really governed as the work the system insider. And, you know, like it or not, it really has been a lot of change.
So, listeners, what do you think about this idea that the stimulus bill, the Recovery Act, really was the change that President Obama had campaigned on? 212-433-WNYC, or any question or comment for Michael Grunwald from Time Magazine, whose new book is called The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. 212-433-9692, or post your comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And let's go down some of the items on your list. The biggest middle-class tax cut since Reagan. People forget or never realized that a third of that $787 billion, is that the right number, a third,
right,
was in tax cuts. Why so under-recognized?
You know, there's a story in my book that I tell that, you know, this book isn't just an argument, it's a narrative. And I think, I hope people will really enjoy reading it. But if you're an Obama supporter, your head is going to explode when you read about the making work pay tax cuts. People may remember that under Bush, there was a stimulus. It was about $180 billion. They sent everybody a check. We all remember it.
And it got mocked and derided.
It got mocked and derided.
$30 in the mail, so what?
Exactly.
A couple of $100.
Exactly.
Even.
And then, of course, the economy collapsed after that. Well, the Obama economists, they were going to be smarter than that, because behavioral economics shows that when you get a check in the mail, you're more likely to save it. You're less likely to spend it, which is the whole point of stimulus. So they very cleverly decided that they would sort of drip your tax cuts into your weekly paycheck a few dollars at a time so no one would notice it.
So
it was then nobody notices it.
Policy versus communication. They didn't get the political credit
exactly
for doing what they concluded was
Rahm
the
Emanuel,
better policy.
Rahm Emanuel was running around saying that we're denying ourselves our Ed McMahon moment, right? That squeal of publishers' clearinghouse pleasure that you get when your check from Obama comes. So actually, less than 10% of the country realized that the stimulus cut their taxes, but more than 95% of the country got tax cuts.
And 2.5 million jobs, and I looked it up, the Congressional Budget Office supports that number.
That's right.
But
so does every private forecaster who's looked at it.
But to use the Obama administration's phrase, does that mean jobs were either created or saved, and that 2.5 million is one or the other, including all those public employees who just got the state and local government aid that kept them from being laid off?
Well, you know, created or saved has become this kind of punchline. I know when Obama did his annual Thanksgiving pardon, he joked that he had just created or saved 4 turkeys. But basically, it just means that there were 2.5 million more jobs than there would have been without this thing. And that's, of course, the big problem, because you had an 8 million job hole. People think of change as perfection. You know, what change is sort of better, right? And better is better than worse.
But
the alternative.
What was it change? If you're going to argue that this is the new deal and that Obama is in some respect the new FDR for the stimulus.
Different, but yeah.
on infrastructure, for example, sure. FDR's new deal created the WPA, which built things that people still see and use today. The Obama stimulus was originally going to be lots of private sector jobs created. We remember shovel-ready projects that were going to go to green infrastructure. But then it changed to saving a lot of existing jobs, as much of it, among state and local government workers, teachers, police officers, others. Not that that wasn't necessarily a worthy thing to do, but it didn't create nearly as much change as a result. It basically preserved more of the status quo.
Well,
do you disagree with that?
I do disagree. I mean, partly it didn't, you know, this was the idea, right? You had this epic collapse in the fourth quarter of 2008. I mean, the sort of financial earthquake had hit, but the tsunami hadn't really reached the shore. People don't realize that our economy was collapsing at a 9% annual rate. At that rate, you lose the entire economy of Canada in a year. So the idea that, you know, 2% growth that we've got now is bad, but if he hadn't poured the money in right away to sort of save some of those teachers' jobs and firefighter jobs and prevent that sort of falling off a cliff, you know, it was sort of like Wile E. Coyote had stepped off the cliff, but you know, holding the anvil, we hadn't started
right
to fall.
But that's less change and more of a big Band-Aid, even if necessary.
Well,
isn't
if you'll excuse my language, as Christy Romer told me, depressions really, really suck. And the alternative to a depression
that's
is
Obama really economic advisor Christine Romer.
And exactly. And that really is change. But then, you know, this idea that there's no real legacy projects in here is not true either. We've got a half dozen of the world's largest solar farms, the world's largest wind farm. You've created an entire advanced battery industry for electric vehicles entirely from scratch. So you've got 30 factories where before you had none. You've got these electronic medical records that by 2015, just our entire pen and paper healthcare system will essentially go online. So your doctor won't kill you anymore with this chicken scratch handwriting. You had a homeless prevention program that had $20 million in 2008 and suddenly got $1.5 billion and kept 1.2 million people off the streets, so that during the Great Recession, the homeless population actually declined a bit, which is just astonishing. Again, it's hard to make the case it could have been worse. It, you know, makes a lousy bumper sticker. You know, something like Race to the Top, which is trying to reform education for the future. It's hard to say, hey, look at this, look at that. We're collecting more data. We're inspiring more standards. But the idea is that in the short short term, there was recovery and preventing this disaster. In the long term, you're really starting to do the kind of change that he said he was going to do.
Michael Grunwald, Time Magazine national correspondent, his new book, The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And Dan in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's a lovely show you have, a nice show you have.
Thank you.
Yes. I heard an economist say, and I'm sorry, I forget his name. He's saying that the stimulus package, as it is now, is at a maybe decent bandage. But he's saying in order for that stimulus to be self-sustaining, to take on a life of itself, to actually help grow the economy, it needed more money, maybe twice the amount of money that was at the Congress actually gave the president.
I'm glad you brought that up, Dan, because one of the other things in the book is that you tell the whole backstory of how the stimulus bill came to take its final form. And Christine Romer, who you mentioned a minute ago, was pushing a much bigger one, as you describe, $1.8 trillion instead of $787 billion,
right? Well, actually, I kind of debunked that a bit.
Oh, you do?
She sort of, you know, that became a big deal about 6 months ago. People said, oh, Romer wanted $1.8 trillion. Even she says like that. She was just describing that was the size of the output gap. She was not advocating for a $1.8 trillion stimulus.
But Paul Krugman and others have been out there writing about how it really did need to be bigger become self-sustaining, as Dan says.
And you know, I hope people will read the kind of raucous story of how this thing came into law. Because one thing, it's absolutely true that, you know, more tax cuts would have put more money in people's pockets, more state aid would have saved more teachers' jobs, you know, more public works would have created more jobs for unemployed laborers, but there was no appetite in Congress for one dime more than $800 billion. Not only did the three Republicans whose votes were needed to get to 60 in the Senate, not only did they say absolutely no more than 800, but so did at least half a dozen centrist Democrats, and that story's never been told. I think there's this, it's important to realize that for all people who are disappointed with the pace of change or the rate of change, that bills that don't pass Congress don't make change at all. And that is the sort of – what the stimulus did is set the narrative of the Obama presidency that with – you know, I have a lot of new reporting about how the Republicans decided, even before he took office, that they were just going to say no. They were going to oppose him on everything. That really set up this challenge where Obama, the kind of tyranny of getting to 60 in the Senate, was really the arc of the Obama presidency. And considering that, you know, it wasn't always pretty, you know, it required some compromises and deals, but he did it on the stimulus, he did it on health care, he did it on financial reform, despite some pretty adamant opposition. That's sort of the untold story of change that I'm talking about.
Stuart in Seacliff, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stuart.
You're in my hometown.
Good morning, Brian. Great job. It's always great show. Great to be on again.
Thank you.
And I just want to say I'm in total agreement with the writer here. And you could tell the stimulus was a success just from all the Republicans that did ribbon-cutting ceremonies from stimulus-funded projects.
That's right. There were 128, they called them cash and trash House Republicans, who sort of voted against it and then asked the Obama administration for money, including a guy who you may have heard of named Paul Ryan, who asked for four or five projects. Not only that, but what I always like to point out, that's only kind of mildly hypocritical, but almost all of the House Republican caucus voted for a stimulus alternative that was $715 billion and almost identical to the Obama stimulus. It had less green stuff. It had more Army Corps of Engineers pork. It didn't have, you know, artists and AmeriCorps, but very similar. It was never explained how $715 billion worth of spending and tax cuts was good public policy, while $787 billion was tyrannical socialism, the death of American free enterprise.
Quote unquote. But you also write that Obama believed that some congressional Republicans would cooperate, considering the national emergency that we were in at the moment, and maybe because they also had a bill that was not so dissimilar. The Obama White House didn't expect the lockstep opposition that they got?
I think if certainly at the beginning they were surprised by the vehemence of after Republicans had demanded $300 billion in tax cuts and they came up with a plan with $300 billion in tax cuts to suddenly hear that this was big government and exploding the deficit when they had just inherited a record $1.2 trillion deficit. So I think they were a little surprised by the vehemence, by the inability of the media to call out obvious factual inaccuracies. You know, these you still hear about sod on the mall and condoms and, the levitating trains to Disneyland and snow-making machines in Duluth and mob museums and all kinds of stuff that is just not in the bill. But I think the Republicans understood that, as long as they could keep this thing controversial, Americans, they sort of look at Washington. They don't pay attention to the details. Things are either bipartisan, which means reasonable people have sort of figured it out, or else it's just the same old Washington bickering.
Did they anticipate the Tea Party or something like it springing up in vehement reaction to such a big government program? Or did they miscalculate and think that that strain didn't exist as strongly in America anymore?
No, I think they knew to some extent what they were up against, even if they were a little bit surprised by how fast it arose during an economic emergency. I tell one story about how one of the top White House aides was talking to Larry Summers. And this is a guy who absolutely believes in Keynesian economics. But he's saying, we're telling people that, this disaster was caused by banks spending, gambling with money they don't have and homeowners taking out loans we can't afford. And now we're going to come out and say $800 billion in borrowed money is going to solve this problem. I mean, it's going to be a tough sell. And Larry sort of shrugs and says, well, yeah, but you got to do what you got to do. They understood what they were up against. After that sort of famous meeting in Chicago on December 16th, when Obama first found out just that, that things weren't bad, they were awful, they were falling off a cliff. After that meeting, David Axelrod said to him, I already know three things. One is that your 70% approval ratings are not going to hold up. I know that all of us who are geniuses today are going to look like idiots, and I know that we're going to have a really tough midterm election in 2010. And he was right about that. I mean, for all the Republican distortion and Democratic bad messaging and, media just really screwing up the stimulus, essentially this was a jobs bill passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging. And that's a really tough case to make. Even a $2 trillion stimulus wasn't going to start creating jobs in time to turn this thing around and make people love it.
If it really worked, would we have more than the anemic job growth that we have today in the private sector, as opposed to it kind of, falling away once the stimulus money actually ran out?
Well, again, the stimulus was not designed to create full employment, as Joe Biden told me in his kind of quirky way. It was never the horse that was supposed to carry the whole sleigh. I think, it was supposed to go along with the housing policy with additional stimulus. And people don't realize that Obama actually did get $700 billion in additional stimulus in 2009 and 2010. But it was a lot harder than he thought. You had Republicans opposing things like unemployment benefits and small business tax cuts that had always been, completely uncontroversial. I think, more stimulus would have been better. That's why Obama was pushing the American Jobs Act in 2011, which, of course, went nowhere. My argument was not that everything is perfect today or even that the stimulus did everything it said it would. It didn't live up to the hype. But, like I always say, the only thing in life that lives up to the hype is parenthood.
Or down to the hype.
Hey,
or up to the
hype. Greatest.
Michael Grunwald, we have just a couple of minutes left with him, Time Magazine national correspondent, author of The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. You didn't hear yesterday's show with Amy Sohn about the parents of Park Slope and how unhappy they are. You told
me. Smile, it's fun.
Before you go, how old are your kids?
I got a 4 and a 2.
That's great.
It's the best.
Working hard at that age.
I'm reintroducing myself to them now that I've finished this book.
Finished the book and then the book tour, and then you'll reintroduce yourself
right.
to them.
That's right.
You told the caller from Seacliff that's near your hometown. Did you grow up on Long Island?
I grew up in Long Island, and now I live in the I grew up in Greenville, and now I'm in the public policy paradise of South Beach. And I have to say, I spent 9 years at the Washington Post, but if I still lived in Washington, I don't think I could have written this book. The groupthink is just too strong. Like saying that the stimulus was anything other than a joke, people just look at you funny.
And people who know your previous work think of you as somebody from Florida. You wrote The Swamp, which is about the Everglades and the politics of paradise, as you called it, and you live in South Florida, don't you?
I do. So, yeah, I think it was really helpful to, you know, I heard about the stimulus not from the kind of the prevailing narrative of it being preposterous, but from covering energy and knowing that, oh my God, this is, you know, we're doubling renewables, we're creating this smart grid. We've got this brand new battery industry. There's $25 billion for energy efficiency when before we were spending a few hundred million dollars a year. This is going to reduce our energy bills. We're going to be less dependent on foreign petro thugs. You know, we're going to reduce our carbon emissions. And then it just got me curious, like what else was in this thing? And it wasn't investigative reporting. It was more like a Google search. Oh, my God, this thing's huge.
Look what actually happened as a result of this. So is it too off the topic to ask if your adopted home state is now more likely to go for Obama because Paul Ryan is on the ticket scaring seniors in Florida, which is such a crucial state, especially for Romney?
I think the Ryan plan is kind of toxic. There's a reason they're trying to re-spin it. People in Florida like their Medicare, and I think, I think I do talk about Ryan and the Republicans in the book as this, that what's interesting is not just their plans, but their hypocrisy, that Mitt Romney had the largest stimulus plan of all the candidates running in 2008. It was only in January 20th, 2009 that suddenly this stuff became, controversial left-wing lunacy. So I think in Florida, there's a lot of people are not happy about the state of the economy, but people do like their Medicare and they do like their government benefits. People may not know that the stimulus lifted 7 million people out of poverty, but that's the sort of thing that Obama's going to try to get out there.
Do you think they cannot get that the Ryan plan only kicks in with Medicare reform for people who are currently under 55, or that they don't believe it?
Well, to me, that's sort of typical of this kind of, reading my book, you're not going to get a sense that, oh my God, these Republicans are nuts. You're going to get a sense that, oh my God, these Republicans care only about politics. And I think putting out a plan for Medicare that is so great that we're not going to apply it to anybody who gets Medicare or might get Medicare soon, I think is a kind of classic example of, supporting stimulus as long as it isn't President Obama's stimulus or, voting against this socialist enterprise, except when it's the socialist enterprises in my district. Yeah.
Michael Grunwald, national correspondent for Time Magazine, author now of The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Garrett Kaiser on our changing notions of privacy in the Facebook world and the face-to-face world, including why he says privacy and privatization seem to be at odds. Stay with us.